going to be surprises. There's going to be things you don't know about. Your parents, your aging loved ones have had a robust life and they've made their decisions and they've done the best they can, right? They're not going to have enough money to pay for care. Like, just don't get in the mindset where, you know, well, if we find X amount, it doesn't matter. We're living so long. No one has enough money. You're going to outlive your money. It's 100% chance. So just let's do the best we can with what's there.
Welcome to Now or Never, Long-Term Care Strategy with Costa Yepafonsif, a podcast for all those seeking answers and solutions in the long-term care space. This podcast is designed to create resources, start conversations, and bring awareness to the industry that will inevitably impact all Americans. Here's your host, Costa Yepafonsif.
Hey, y'all, it's Costa. Today, I'm here with my guest, Kimberly Wider, co-founder of the Whole Care Network, CEO of Elder Care Solutions, and founder of the Care Colloquium, a first-of-its-kind national thought leadership conference for leaders in the care economy. Today, we're talking about how to pay for senior care in a recession. Kimberly, to set a framework for the rest of the episode, what does it look like financially for the average American to unexpectedly need senior care?
I think for most Americans, this is just surprisingly expensive. We are not prepared for how little of long-term care is actually covered by our support systems that are in place. And so it's always a shock. And then if it's not addressed, it doesn't take more than about a year for it to potentially become financially devastating. So that's what a lot of American families are dealing with.
What do you typically see them doing whenever they're confronted with this need to have care for a loved one? I mean, I'm assuming there's a lot of scrambling that's going on.
That's exactly the word I was going to use, okay. Scrambling. It's like they're scrambling because the priority is someone needs help. They need care. They need services. You just do what you need to do to put it in place. And then when everything's kind of settled, you're like, wait a minute. How much am I forking over? How often? Yeah. Why isn't this covered? And then it's just like, wait a minute. You know, we need to figure something out. And then the scrambling begins, right?
And I'll tell you, some of the things that I've confronted in my experiences is there's so much that people can't pay for that they have to take on themselves. And I'm just looking at like a 24-hour day, and I'd say like they could pay for like maybe 6 hours, right? But there's still another 18 hours that are left. And a lot of people, and I'm curious to see if you encounter this, like they have to quit their jobs and all that stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, there's a number of hours in a day, and depending on what kind of care your loved one needs, it could be they're okay. They just need someone to pop over. And then it goes all the way to the spectrum. They need somebody there 24/7, right? And most 24/7 care is so unaffordable that that's why we have this huge influx of, you know, our average of 53 million people who are like, well, I'll just step in and help out. That's the right thing to do, right? Yeah. And they're spending so much time. The national average for that is 21 hours a week on care tasks. That's a part-time job.
Wow.
And about 25% of family caregivers are pushing 40 hours a week, which is a full-time job. So how can you juggle a career and other competing priorities when you have a part-time or full-time job just with care, right?
Yeah. So let's talk about the different things that people, the different aspects of long-term care that people can access depending on the individual's needs. Mm-hmm. So no matter what the state of the economy is, the cost of in-home care versus assisted living can vary greatly and is normally very, very expensive. Would you talk about the pros and cons of each from a financial perspective?
Sure. So national average, right? And this is, it flux and it wax and wanes, right? So in-home care is about $25 an hour.
Okay.
Assisted living is about $6,000 a month.
Okay.
And then in your geographical locations where cost of living is higher, of course, those numbers skyrocket. They pop up, right? But that's your average. So to get that scale to be exactly equal, if you need 8 hours of care for your loved one 7 days a week, you're at the same cost at $6,000 a month. So that's kind of a really great metric for families to say, if we hit that point where our loved one needs 8 hours of care every day, 7 days a week, is it the right thing to stay at home? And if so, let's figure that out. Or is assisted living an option for us? Because if we teeter much more, it's actually going to become more cost effective to be there. Now, we know most people want to age in place, and I absolutely agree with that. But financially, which is this is the lens we're looking at this. That's really your tipping point financially to say, okay, we have some decisions. Which option do we want? Which one's smarter? What's going to make everyone have the most dignified aging experience, right?
Sure. And I'll even take it a step further. As people that are receiving these services, as they age and decline in health, there's going to naturally be a necessity for family members or loved ones or neighbors, friends to step in and bridge the gap sometimes outside of that 8 hour window.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, imagine, and I just want to paint a picture for the audience. Imagine if somebody is aging in place and you've successfully, which is also a very difficult thing to do, but you've successfully found a caregiver and you're paying them $25 an hour. Let's say you're not going through an agency and they're coming in 8 hours a day while you're working, right? And usually, like you and I, whenever we end our work day, we want to go home and try to relax, right? And get ready for the next day, right? Kids, what have you. There's a lot of times where they have to step in varying hours of the evening time or early morning time to support that individual before the staff member shows up to provide those services. I want to ask, though, when you're having these conversations with people, how difficult is it to convince somebody, just from your own perspective, somebody that's receiving services at home, but they're trying to transition them to assisted living because it's just more appropriate? Let's say they get 8 hours a day, but they just can't. The unknowns, the variables that keep coming up day in and day out are just too intense for them. How hard is it to have that conversation to get people to accept that maybe they can't age in place and it's time to go to an assisted living?
Well, I've never been in a position where I am the one trying to convince someone to make that choice. They already have. It's an emotion that's holding them back. It's guilt. It's sadness. It's fear. It's something like that, that saying, like, I really know this is the best option. What's holding me back is I feel extremely guilty to take this step, or I'm scared to do it because I can't control the level of care anymore, right? Like someone else is going to be there. It makes me incredibly sad to do that, right? So that's what we end up managing is the emotion.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. And there's a lot of emotion in all of this, and we'll get a little bit later about how we can sort of start the conversation with families. And I've got some very exciting, not exciting, but interesting stories that I've confronted even with my own parents and friends that have tried to talk to their loved ones about, hey, you know, are you thinking about this at all? Right? You know?
Yeah.
And they're like, no, I'm not. Don't talk to me about it.
Hey, let's talk about that later. Okay, bye.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get back to the recession and the financial costs of care. During a recession, budgeting becomes critical for families of all incomes. What are some of the most common financial mistakes families make when planning for senior care?
Yeah. So the most common mistake is we will consistently put this on the back burner, right? Like, it's not fun. We're not biting at the bit to be like, oh, I can't wait to go dive into my loved one's finances, like look at their budget. Right. So it's something we will naturally just like, well, I'll get to that later when I have more time or whenever we can get into a deeper conversation. And that just goes on for a very long time. So that's the mistake. What I will say is there are two super easy things that actually are a little bit more fun to look at that can sometimes promote and motivate people to, okay, let's actually look at the budget, right? So one of them is, you know, a lot of our our aging loved ones, they're on Medicare. They hit 65. And when that happens, we don't take a look at some of these other supplemental policies, financial products that they've put in place all throughout their life. And so now they're sitting on kind of a nest of multiple little things. And sure. Once Medicare is put in place, a lot of times it can make some of the other things redundant. And you're just spending monthly money, sending off checks to some of these policies that are absolutely unneeded anymore.
Okay.
And so there are individual brokers who they get paid by the different policy carriers. So Anthem, Aetna, United Healthcare, they get paid by them whenever they sell policies. So they work with families for free. Okay. And they are so knowledgeable about what all these policies have because it's their job to know, right?
Sure.
So if you tap into one of these individual independent brokers and say, can you just take a look at all these insurance products that my parents are sitting on and tell me, like, what do I absolutely not need? Is there a better policy Medicare wise for them so that it covers what care actually looks like and what their health looks like today? I have saved a family $4,000 a year just by shaking wow. out stuff. You know, so there's yeah. money there that you can just like, oh, these are premiums we don't have to pay anymore. Right?
What type of policies do they have that are considered redundant?
People will carry like supplemental health policies. Some okay. people will have things like Aflac, Global Life that are emergency mm-hmm. care or cancer care or, you right. know, because, right. you know, we hit these different age milestones like 40 sure. and 50. And we're like, yeah, I want that. I'm scared that that's going to happen. Right?
Yeah.
But then when we hit 65, sometimes that's covered under our bigger Medicare policies.
Right.
The other thing is like, we have really gotten into subscriptions in the past 20 years. And so magazine subscriptions, mailer subscriptions, streaming services subscriptions, some of these also become like absolutely unneeded or inaccessible to our loved ones as they age. And so we can easily be spending, you know, $12 here, $13 here, $20 here a month, and they're not needed. They can't even access them anymore. Or like for entertainment purposes, libraries have free movies, free DVDs for shows. Sometimes some of that is exactly what they need, and you can just get rid of some of that. So that can be a little more fun. It's super easy, and that's a way to get your like toes dipped in the budget, right?
When somebody reaches out to you and says, hey, you know, we need to have this conversation with, you know, we need you to be sort of the intermediary between the individual who needs services and the family members. How does that process work? Do they go to a website? Do they call a phone number? Do you have like a team that refers these people to you? I'm just curious, like, what is your like operation kind of look like?
Yeah.
What does it entail?
So I actually focus more on education and empowerment. And okay. I have something called a CarePay tool that I created. Okay. Nice. And so it is an online platform where I have boiled down what I need to know about a family it's about 12 questions. And all these questions are formatted in yes, no answers. So it's super fast. Like I just need realities. I don't need like bank accounts and numbers. And
sure.
I am not a financial advisor, nor do I sell financial products. I'm just an educator and dot connector,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So when they answer these questions on the CarePay tool, it will match up to them relevant strategies that exist out in the financial world that come from financial advisors, elder law attorneys, CPAs, people who are experts on how to release home equity into like more liquid forms of assets, budgeters, these independent brokers, and then of course, Medicare, Medicaid, and veteran benefits. So a lot of professional perspectives are represented there, and it gives them every strategy one by one. And I educate them on it with like a video and narrative and resources that they can download.
So they go to the tool mm-hmm. and they fill out the questionnaire.
Get this big report with so yes. many things that they probably didn't know about.
So they get the report
mm-hmm.
and they go to their family member who needs care
mm-hmm.
and they start to have this conversation. So here's the million-dollar question. The through line of nearly every senior care conversation I've had in the past 20 years is, I wish we'd had the conversation sooner. How do you suggest families approach those difficult conversations around financial planning for senior care?
Sure. I tend to focus on the emotional aspect of this. So finances is so personal. Mm-hmm. And it's just our culture, right? Like, it's very personal. And we hold our financial cards close to our heart and get very defensive over them. And we're super private about them. And so our, of course, our aging loved ones are the same way.
Right.
And so instead
Probably
of
even more so.
More so. Instead of coming in with, I really feel you're mismanaging your money or you're not taking care of things, I need to step in and help you, which is instantly going to put them in, you know, let's put our defense walls up and I'm going to say no. Let's hit it more with a safe space of, if you were ever in a position where you couldn't make the decisions or communicate what you wanted about your finances, what are some things that you can tell me so I can make sure that that's done for you? Mm-hmm. Or what are your boundaries when it comes to your finances? What are things that are absolute strict boundaries and then things that you actually do feel comfortable talking about? I want to make sure that those are respected. Right. So those types of spaces that we can create where it's just, I want to uphold your dignity. I want to love you the most I can by making sure your boundaries are in place and I can advocate for you. I'm not here to control. I'm here to make sure what you want to happen happens, right? And that tends to open the door a little bit easier. I'm not saying it's always the magic key and I'm not saying you won't have to repeat that conversation.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, what happens when you open up those finances and it's not good?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you ever console or have that emotional conversation with people when they realize, like, oh wait, I'm woefully unprepared? They may not be in crisis, but they're at least taking the necessary steps just to give the audience some, you know, step one, step two, step three type of action plan. What do you do if you open up those finances and they're bad and they don't have the money to pay for care?
Sure. Well, one, I hardly talk to adult children who aren't surprised by something in their aging loved one's finances. Yeah. And usually it's not great surprises like, oh my God, they're sitting on $1 million. It's more like, I didn't know how much debt they had. So there's going to be surprises. There's going to be things you don't know about. Your parents, your aging loved ones have had a robust life and they've made their decisions and they've done the best they can, right? Mm-hmm. Two, they're not going to have enough money to pay for care. Like, just don't get in the mindset where, you know, well, if we find X amount, it doesn't matter. We're living so long. No one has enough money. You're going to outlive your money. It's 100% chance. Yeah. So just let's do the best we can with what's there. So get ready there, you know. And then three, let's get some things in place that are going to be smart. So that financial power of attorney is really important because you can really do nothing until you have it. And it's not a document that gets signed and now you have absolute control. It's a document that gets signed that says, if they can't manage this themselves or if they are incapacitated, now you can do something. And if that happens and you don't have that document, you're just standing at the bank and they will give you nothing. They won't talk to you. And that's a heartbreaking situation to be in. So let's put up some things so that when you need to make decisions, you're actually able to.
Yeah, for sure. And I want to set this next question up with something that you just said about we predominantly will not have the opportunity to pay for long-term care because we're living longer, and I'm going to throw some stats out, because only about 20% of Americans save for retirement. It's like 20, we'll just call it 25% to be gracious. And the average 401k is between $200,000 and $350,000. And I mean, you and I both know that long-term care costs, I mean, if it's $6,000 a month, that's $72,000 a year.
You get like 2 years out. Yeah. And exactly. Another stat, only 20% of Americans have enough money to give them 2 years of long-term care.
There you go. So I guess that leads me to my next question is, you've mentioned this many times, and I totally agree that our long-term care infrastructure is nationally broken. During this time, what systemic changes do you believe could help us most?
Sure. So, not a policymaker, but I am someone who has helped people navigate this incredibly fragmented and siloed, and I hate to even use the word system because a system implies that it's somehow it's working together, sure. And it's not, right?
Right.
So there's just a lot of silos out there that sometimes touch each other and many times do not. Medicare absolutely has to change.
Yeah.
It has to change. It was put in place in the 1940s and it predominantly has been untouched. And the way that we age in 2023 looks, it's been flipped on its head. It looks so completely different. It's a full 180 of what it used to look like. And the supports that Medicare provides barely touches the iceberg of what people need when they're aging in 2023. And if we do anything, it really needs expansion in coverage for home and community-based care.
Yeah. And I know that some Medicare Advantage plans offer like a benefit, like a small component, or they started, I think, in 2021, offering a benefit like that. Traditional Medicare doesn't pay for long-term care.
Doesn't even touch it.
Right.
Doesn't even touch it.
Yeah. After 100 days, you are essentially on your own.
Because it's short-term care, not long-term care.
Correct. Exactly. Yeah. I guess it just humor me. I know you're not a policymaker and I'm not a policymaker, but we like to talk about policy on the show on occasion. And if you think about all of the drama that we have in Congress about people that are railing against our entitlement spending for specifically Medicare, because it's the second largest line item in the federal budget below Social Security, but they're both kind of tied to the same population, right? And I've had this conversation recently, so it's kind of fresh. It's top of mind right now. Medicaid, okay, is a state-run program. So there's 50 states, there's 50 Medicaid plans. Right?
That's right.
And every single state in the United States, their number one line item, their number one budget is Medicaid. So it takes disproportionately the state's budget to facilitate Medicaid. How do we convince people in Congress, again, I know you're not a policymaker or a lobbyist, but I'm curious to hear your perspective. How do you convince people in Congress that they should allow for long-term care in the Medicare benefit and absorb 25% of 50 states' budgets? Or here's the second aspect to that question, if you can't really give a whole lot of credence to the first one. What happens if we don't do anything?
Yeah. So I feel like my best answer can come from I'm an academic, so I really approached when I got into this work of people are getting financially devastated by long-term care, immediately I was like, why is this happening? So I started diving into the why, right? And I uncovered what I call the perfect storm that's brewing for our citizens in the US that are experiencing longevity, which is a lot. One, they're living a lot longer. And we say that a lot, but I can put numbers to it. So our people who are 65 years old or older live 19 years on average longer than their counterpart in the generation just before them, which means in layman's terms, in one generation, we gained 2 decades of life. That's what happened on average. Okay.
Wow.
So the story of our lives or our life, like, cycle used to be, you know, like we were young and we went to college and then we got married and we got that great job and maybe had children, reached the pinnacle of our career. And then we retired and then we did some bucket item list things. And then our parents needed some help and we helped them out. And it was maybe, if it was a long time, 5 years to help them.
Sure.
And then they passed away and now we're old people, right?
Yeah.
What it looks like today is We go to college. Maybe we get married. Maybe we have kids. We hit the pinnacle of our career. And now our parents are old enough to need our help because they had us later and they're living for a pretty long time. Right.
Yeah.
And so now we have this huge group of people who are at the peak of their career. They have kids that are still their, you know, their responsibility. Sure. They have parents who need their help. And the amount of time they're going to spend helping their parents could be 20 to 30 years. Like, it could be a very long time.
Wow.
And when do you do your bucket item?
Sure.
Things, right. Yeah. So that's a whole new lifespan. Then what we need in this really long late chapter of life looks completely different. So Medicare was set up for medical care. We are a predominantly healthy, chronic conditioned elderly generation. That's what we're seeing right now. So the baby boomers, in addition to being an incredibly large generation and a generation that's living for a very long time, they are the first generation in history to experience modern medicine since the moment that they were born, which means now in their late chapter, they have very well managed chronic conditions, and chronic conditions for them were death sentences for the silent generation.
Kind of like the high blood pressure medication.
High blood pressure. Cancer can be a chronic condition. Congestive heart failure, diabetes. These are chronic conditions that you can live. You can live out your life. You can have a 20 to 30 year late chapter of life with medication. Do you need that much medical care? No. But do you need some help, like getting around? Maybe you can't drive that much anymore. It's hard for you to eat healthy meals because cooking and standing takes a lot out of you. Yes. And then we have Medicare that hasn't been touched since it was put in place. Right. And it does not touch long-term care, which is absolutely what everyone that we are aging and helping with need for a long time. So this is what this... this story is what policymakers need to hear. This story is what policymakers are living. They are in this generation, experiencing this themselves. They have to see that a lot of what they need help with isn't getting covered by their Medicare, right? And then there's this huge gap. Yes, Medicaid does have better long-term care coverage, but Medicaid is really hard to get on.
Yeah.
It's really hard to reach. We live in a nation full of middle-class citizens. We have too many assets, right? And to get those assets down can be devastating, heartbreaking. We lose financial legacies. And then once we meet it, are we on a waiting list for years? We don't have the solution. There are not solutions out there.
Surely they know all of this, right?
Sure.
I mean, especially given, like you said, they're at the age where they're probably receiving Medicare. And I think it's, here's my take on everything that you just said. First off, I agree with all of it. We've created a perfect storm, I think, through inaction.
Exactly.
That's kind of like how we operate as a species. Climate change. We'll take care of it eventually, you know, all that stuff. But I digress. I feel like the people who are in positions of influence, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you are somebody making, let's say, $200,000 a year, and you have a parent that has a savings of $100,000, maybe has a house that's close to being paid off. And here's something that I just realized recently. What if they have a life insurance policy that hasn't termed out that they can borrow against?
Right.
So like the amount of money necessary to pay for long-term care, there's so many vehicles that they can use to dip in these different buckets to try to get to a point where they can find enough money to pay for the services. Is that a common theme, or is that just me looking at it, you know, from a 1,000-foot view and saying, surely this is probably what's happening all over the United States?
This is absolutely what's happening all over the United States.
Okay.
Right. So what policymakers are saying is this would be so incredibly expensive for us to fund.
Right.
So let's not do that right now.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Which means let's leave it to the families to figure out how to pay for it.
Yeah.
Right. But so yes, that's what's happening. But do these families know some of these strategies?
No. I see. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Are they available to them? Yes. Do they navigate them with ease and it's so easy to learn about them and find professionals that will share that knowledge with you? Absolutely not. And then add in the layer that most of the time when they go to professionals just to ask questions and gain knowledge, they're sitting in front of someone who wants to sell them something.
Right.
Then it's just really hard to get through this. And that just discourages them, makes them pull back and stop asking questions because now they feel very vulnerable, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, let's brass tacks. Let's talk about these strategies. Let's say you're somebody that wants to age in place or you have a family member who needs long-term care, but they also want to age in place. What are some of those strategies that you recommend for families to make this financially viable? But sure. With a caveat. What happens if there is a recession? Will it be harder to make those strategies viable?
Sure. So in a recession, less money's floating around the economy, right?
Right.
And so when that happens for a family, which is really where I'm focused, I'm family facing, right?
Yeah.
You know, it could have meant that they took a hit on their savings and their long-term savings now, the number is less than it was because something happened. Economically, heartbreaking, you know. So to prepare for that, let's go talk to our financial advisors and say, how can we protect this, get that aggression level down as much as possible? Because we're at a place now, really, we just want to hold the money. We're not trying to grow it, you know, things like that. You know, when it comes to the services, it could mean that now the prices start doing this because everybody's trying to figure out, well, what do I charge now? There's less people coming. Do we raise our prices? Do we, you know, so it's harder to predict how much it's going to cost to get the care. It could be less, could be more. Okay. You don't know, you know, and these service providers they could have less staff. Maybe they've had to lay people off. Then they don't have as many people that can provide the care. So you tap into a place, you're like, okay, I could afford this for this amount of time, but then they have no one to send your way to help you. You know, so it really puts a wrench in a lot of different places for a recession.
Yeah.
So then the financial planning part, because you had a 20-part question. Thank you.
I know. I'm sorry.
These are big questions. They're big questions. So first off, I always say, think about Medicaid first. Let's function under the reality that at some point in your future, you're going to need it.
Right.
It's not like if, some point, right? So this is where an elder law attorney becomes incredibly valuable to be on your team because they really help you map out this timeline to say, you know, okay, based on your assets that you have and what your picture looks like estate-wise, let's teeter around 8 years from now might be a really great time.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, what financial decisions can we make now to say, we want to make sure Medicaid never knows about this in the most legal way possible.
Right.
We want to make sure Medicaid doesn't touch this. We're happy to spend down this and tap that, you know, and so we start building this picture and timeline. Okay. Then let's look at the easy stuff first. And that is always, how can you get the cheapest care or make the cost of care as low as possible? And I have four strategies for that.
Nice.
So area agencies on aging, which I'm sure you talked about before with other guests, incredibly valuable. What I just find, families have no idea that they exist in their areas. And so I always provide education that, you know, you have these agencies that are state funded. The staff there are paid and they're waiting for you to come access them. And if you just call them up and say, this is what I'm going through. I'm caring for mom or dad. This is the kind of stuff they need help with. What do you have? You're going to get navigated to something. And the programs that they have are either completely free for you or very, very low cost. Like they'll put them on a sliding scale. I have found extreme variability in area agencies on aging. Some of them have very little programming because they're not getting access enough to even get the grant monies to provide the programs. And then some of them have 10 hours of home care absolutely free, you know, like, which is incredible. Wow. So you just don't know until you tap in. Another easy thing is know your loved one's diagnosis. I get a lot of families that are like, you know, they're just not acting the same. I'm pretty sure they have dementia. If we really are thinking that there's cognitive decline, get that diagnosis, get the cognitive assessment financially, because there's a lot of money floating around out there for dementia and Alzheimer's and other cognitive decline and dysfunction under the dementia umbrella. And they have programs, usually from your area agency on aging, that will be like free care, free support groups, but only if you have a firm diagnosis that this is what your loved one has. And so if you don't have it, you can't tap into it. And then no one else can tap into it either, because that might not be what their loved one is struggling with, you know? And so it's like, it's just sitting there getting unused. So know that diagnosis. And also Parkinson's falls under that, sometimes rare cancers. It's just good to have. So you're like, okay, I know exactly what's going on and I know how to go look for some free services because of that.
Right.
And then I would say for families, like, put together a family care agreement. Like, and we've already covered, these conversations are hard to have, but if you say, what needs to be done and who's willing to step up and do X, Y, and Z,
who's even in charge of what?
Yeah. And if we know home care is $25 an hour, a family care agreement is exactly where you could say, well, what if I charge 12? Mm-hmm. Save us a ton of money, but I do get compensated for some of these 21 hours I'm going to put towards care tasks. This is a really great strategy for a lot of families. Saves them a lot of money.
It's a great point.
The caretaker gets compensated, and it is a legitimate spend down tactic for Medicaid. So it's like a win-win-win, really.
Yeah, that's great. And I just want to give you my perspective. When you were talking about the recession and kind of the unexpectedness of what could happen, my take on what could happen if we were preparing for a recession, or if we were in a recession, we were having to prepare for the changing landscape in long-term care. I think that the demand for care is not going to stop, and it's not going to go down, because as we were talking about, that baby boomer generation, people born between 1946 and 1964, are the second largest population subset in the United States. And they're only like 2 million or 3 million behind millennials. Mm-hmm. There's like 72 million baby boomers. So it's massive. And they're all aging in steadily. And they're going to be for the next 20 to 30, I mean, maybe even 40 years. Who knows? Right. I think that a recession may, in fact, help lower the cost. And let me give you my perspective. So when there is a recession, there's going to be industries that will have layoffs because of a lowering demand. Mm-hmm. Whereas in long-term care, I think the demand will either stay steady or increase. Those employees that were laid off from one industry will funnel into the long-term care space. Not all, but there'll be a percentage of them, which means that there will be an overstaffing of people who want to work for an agency or want to provide the services themselves, which, if you consider the law of economics, when you have an oversupply, you technically would have a lower cost, a lower price point. And with an increase in demand, I think more companies and more caregivers are willing to accept a lower price point. So as difficult as recessions are for the U.S. economy and just the U.S. citizenry in general, it may actually help long-term care to have some softening in the economy so that more people funnel into this space to provide this type, to do this type of work.
It could do. And I mean, you do have this very large demographic of individuals who are demanding. So, you know, like,
yes,
they're going to drive the types of products and services that we see.
Yes.
What I think is
that I'd love to hear your perspective.
They're going to change how these services are provided.
Okay.
The baby boomers are known as a generation for changing industries. Like, they go in And they like, well, we would rather see it like this. And it changes for them because they're so big and they have so much demand. So
largest largest concentration of wealth in the entire country.
So if we get this huge demographic of people who are demanding that, let's say, you know what? We see assisted livings, but what if it looks like this instead and we will flock to it and give you our monies? You know, it'll change for them.
That's a good point.
So I think that they have the power to change the way these services are delivered, which could be for the better.
Yeah, that's a great point. I never actually thought about it like that, but yeah, you're probably right. Because I'm always looking at it from market conditions, and sometimes I forget that market conditions come from the consumer, not from the Fed.
And then follow up at the same time that you have them wanting certain services, you have what's predominantly going to be the millennials who are helping them make decisions, which I'm a part of. And we're not known for being a quiet generation, right? So we're going to be like, this is not great. I was going to. Like, this is not the way we want it to
you
be.
You should We're go and do this. Right? Yeah. This is great.
I think
y'all go
be
do
a lot
this.
Of noise, is what I'm saying. Yeah. I think it'll be disruptive, and I think we need it to be disruptive.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the Lyft is huge, and we talk about it on the show all the time. It just seems like we're working from a deficit, and so many families like you confront every single day. I work with every single day. I mean, a lot of them, 80% of them are coming in crisis, you know, and that's such a difficult place to operate from. And so the more that we can get, you know, if I could have families start talking about this eight years prior to needing these services, I mean, they'll eclipse the look back period. They'll qualify for Medicaid. They'll put their assets in an irrevocable trust. I mean, there's just so many benefits for them, you know?
So. Yeah.
We always like to end the show with a call to action. Looking towards the future, how do you see the role of technology in reducing costs and improving the quality of senior care, especially during economic downturns?
Yeah. I saw this question and I was like, dang, hard, really hard question. So my perspective on this is care is predominantly a service-led industry. Like, so we will need people to provide care services. Technology has a role and really benefits us when it comes to educating us on different kinds of care, helping us find where that care can be given to us, educating us on the different financial strategies we can use for paying for that care, right? So yes, tech has a place there, and it makes it faster. It makes the amount of information that comes to us more robust, and it can even personalize this. So that's incredible. In the care space, tech has a really great opportunity to help coordinate care. And we have the tech now for if we had these incredible, like hubs where all of our information's in one place and everybody's coming to it and pulling the information from it, we could have a more coordinated experience. It's just not working right now. We have, you know, systems use different ones. They don't talk to each other. You know, so if we could get this to be more streamlined, it would be a beautiful way for our care to be more coordinated and more holistic because technology is helping us.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Now or Never, Long-Term Care Strategy with Costa Yepafonsif. If you enjoyed listening and you want to hear more, make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Leave us a review, or better yet, share this episode with a friend. Today's episode was written and produced by Morgan Franklin, production assistance by Mike Franklin. Want to find out more about Costa? Visit us at costayepafonsif.com.